Brett, sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant. Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my neighbour Maureen. Yeah, thank you.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a screenwriter, and I love films. As Lao Tzu once said, to the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders. So do not watch Uncut Gems straight before bed. You know what I mean? Excellent advice, Lao Tzu. Thank you. Every week I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Himesh Patel, Sharon Stone, and even... But this week, it's the brilliant comedian, podcaster, and speaker, Callie Beaton. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 20 minutes of chat, secrets, and videos with Callie. You get all the other episodes with extra stuff, everyone telling the secret, beginnings, endings. You get all the episodes uncut and ad-free, and mostly as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. So, Callie Beaton. Callie Beaton is a brilliant comedian and podcaster. You've seen her on Live at the Apollo. You've seen her on Cats Done Countdown. You've seen her on all the panel shows and all the radio shows. She's very, very brilliant. We recorded this a while back on Zoom, and I really think you're going to love it. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 265 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by an actor, a writer, a TV exec, a podcaster, a panelista, a hero, a radio show megastar, a TV star, and an incredible stand-up comedian. Can't believe she's here, but she is here. Please welcome to the show, it's the brilliant, it's Callie Beaton!
What a generous introduction. I think that's the best ever.
Callie, nice to see you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm just landed from Spain back in my kitchen, only I'm not, am I? I'm not, because I'm dead.
Oh, shit. Oh, you oh, you know about that? Oh, that's never happened. That's never happened before. Yeah, well, we should probably talk about that, but just as a general... Hello, before we get to that, I suppose. very nice kitchen, by the way. It looks fake.
It does look fake. I thought that was a real
it's compliment.
It's very clean. Yeah, so the only kitchen you've ever seen that's so perfect, it looks fake.
It looks totally fake. And I say that with respect.
It's totally not a virtual background. Yeah.
Is your house normally this clean?
Yes, the kitchen is, this bit of the kitchen's clean because I tend to do recordings from such places, yeah.
Is if you were to spin your camera around, is everything chaos?
It's not too bad. You'd probably think I had a slight issue that things are so immaculate. Yeah, you probably wouldn't think I was the most fun type.
How was Spain?
It was lovely. It was really nice. I was there filming some stuff and seeing my daughter who lives over there. We got We got trashy tattoos.
Oh, nice.
We got the same
ones. For the listeners, she's holding up a beautiful heart tattoo on her wrist.
Yeah. So we got those. Mine's slightly infected. Hers is fine.
Oh, shit.
So that's good. Yeah. We shouldn't have gone to some bloke around the back of a tapas bar, should we, after a few beers. Oh, we should have had it done properly.
What's your daughter doing out there?
She is working out there. So she lived out there for a bit. Well, my kids are half Dutch, and she moved to Amsterdam when she was just 18. To study Spanish, and then moved to Madrid to do a master's in Spanish, and now she stayed on there to work. So she's moving away from me in increments.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. There are two things in your, maybe you're sick of talking about them, but they are interesting things in your biography. One is that you were the only girl in an all-boys school.
Yes.
How does that happen? Was there a huge error? Well, I'm sure you've talked about this loads. Forgive me for not.
It was a booking error. No, it was because my parents ran a boarding school in the middle of nowhere in Dorset, and it happened to be a boys' school, and I happened to live in the grounds of the school, and therefore it was the school to which I was sent. I should add, I wasn't like 16, I was 8 when I was sent there. I left when I was 13, by which time a couple of girls had joined, but it wasn't the it wasn't a recipe for, you know, they say sort of comedians are all misfits and kind of band of rogues. I think you start early if you're in a school where you're quite that much of an outsider. I think the land is, the grass is sown.
Do you think it made you think about boys in a certain way that has stuck with you? Do you know what I mean? If you were in this environment where it was just boys, you must be seeing sort of a different thing than most people are seeing.
I think I never really thought about being a woman or a girl in a male environment until I was in my 40s. And I look back at it, and my entire life has been in environments that were largely male. I think when I first got into sort of boardrooms that were entirely male, apart from me, I didn't really even think about the fact that I was the only woman. I think I was so used to being in those environments, and it didn't occur to me to sort of think about it or think if it was a disadvantage. Or it's taken me about 4 decades to realise there is sexism and patriarchy. I think I thought I was part of the problem.
That's fantastic. So the other part of your biography that is fascinating to me is that you were a TV exec.
Yes.
You left that to be a stand-up.
Yes, you'd have been wanting to talk to me much more 10 years ago than you probably do tonight. So I did make the switch from behind the kind of cameras to on front of them, and I wasn't always. I was in comedy. I worked with Comedy Central on and off since the South Park days, the origins of South Park days, so right back in the beginning in whatever it was, 96. So I've worked with kind of comedy, and I've done various jobs with people like Tiger Aspect and sort of different production companies, but my whole TV career wasn't all about comedy. But yes, it was all about telly. And it was all about being the other side of the camera.
So great that you did this. Have you ever had a gig with someone that you rejected as a TV exec?
Yes, but they wouldn't have known that I had anything to do with the rejection. So I'm just flying in. But I have had to beg to get into parties in Edinburgh, parties where they'd have been begging me to come in if it had been a couple of years earlier. I've gone literally from on the list. Of course, you can come into Cali Who. So it's a pretty big status drop I've managed to wish upon myself.
No, it's the opposite. It's the opposite. Cute. I mean, very exciting. So how long have you been doing stand-up now?
About 7 years, nearly 8 years. So yes, so a fair while, I think, yeah.
Have you had to go and pitch TV shows to your old gang?
Yes, I've been really funny about not using my kind of little black book, which I know isn't your question, but I've almost gone the other way to sort of not do that. Also, because I know from, as you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for. You've got to be ready for the things you then get. So it's all very well hustling your way into a show, but unless you're ready to be doing the show, it would be the last hustle you ever did. So I sort of think there is something to be said for you getting the opportunities when you're meant to get them, which isn't when you've been going 5 minutes. Obviously, I'm still quite new relative to stand-up age. But I have now. Yeah, now it's funny that the TV channels for whom I've done nothing yet are Comedy Central and Channel 5, both of which I used to work for. So when I was at Paramount, Viacom, CBS, we owned both of those. And I do think I've just done a little thing for Channel 5, and I think they've just realised that I don't still work there, and they've just started to think of me as possible talent. So it's been really weird. And I think they just couldn't make the leap that I'd changed to doing this.
You went in for a meet with them and they all sat next to you on the sofa like, who are we meeting today? And you're like, me.
Who are we meeting today? Have you got the spreadsheet? And how's the P&L going to look? Are we going to make enough money off this?
And you are on all the panel shows. You've done very well on all the panel shows.
Lots of them. Not all of them, but yes, lots of the nice ones.
Is there a key to it that you think you've learned?
I think there's a key to it, which is also a key to life, the universe and everything.
Oh, well, I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, it's about not waiting until you've got a perfect thing to say, whether you're in a panel show or you're in life, because it's really easy. And women, and this is a gendered thing, there's lots of research about this. Yeah. Women tend to wait until they've got really the right thing to say before they'll say something, where blokes will go diving in, much sooner than that. And if you're waiting and thinking, I'll just wait until I've got the exact right joke, what it is, it's, I would call it making the edit. You've got to make the edit. And by make the edit, I mean, get stuck in, say some stuff, give them lots to work with. Don't worry about being the funniest voice in the room. Just worry about being your voice in the room, because everyone's seen all the other voices. You're the one that they haven't seen if it's a new experience being on the show. And I think that's such a good thing to know in life as well. It doesn't have to be perfect. Yeah. You know, just get something out there and then you're in it and then you've occupied your space and people will listen.
I love it. You know, I'm obsessed with, I'm sure I've said this a number of times on this podcast, but one of my favourite quotes is Lorne Michaels about SNL, that it doesn't go on because it's ready. It goes on because it's Saturday night.
There you go. Yeah, it's perfect. And that exactly sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think that's really good. I mean, that's not to say you shouldn't put some thought into it, like you shouldn't, but I definitely think perfectionism can ruin you and stop you doing anything.
Yeah, and once you start, once you're in, because then you're in the ring, aren't you? And then, of course, the funny bits are the bits that happen with other people and you've made yourself part of that dynamic. Yeah.
If you're with good people and you say something vaguely funny, they will yes and it and make it really funny, and then you've got something going.
Yeah, and you've got, and the bits that you get all the credit for, and rightly so, on those panel shows is the bits that you couldn't have written and you couldn't have rehearsed.
Yeah.
And those do come out of diving in and having that sort of interaction with somebody. So I definitely think I do lots of sort of TED talky stuff and speeches and stuff like that. And I do loads of stuff for kind of removing obstacles to women in kind of work in life and business and stuff. And it's always about that. It's like, don't wait to be perfect. Don't wait to be like the other voices in the room that are, in that case, often male. Just have the confidence in your voice being worth hearing, and don't second guess it. Just get stuck in.
I imagine that you as a comedian would absolutely fucking smash a TED talk because no one's expecting it to be funny.
Yes,
it must be the gig of your life.
It's the lovely. I do say this to comics who hate corporates, and rightly so. So I'm just checking the dog's not having I think he's just got the hiccups. Because I get billed. So I do sort of awards hosting and actual comedy sets at corporates, which, like everybody else, every other right-thinking person finds really difficult. But when I, like, first thing tomorrow, I'm off to do a kind of speech somewhere. And yeah, I always ask them not to bill me as a comedian. They can say I'm like a performer, a writer, whatever. And they say some of my credits from my TV life, like South Park and SpongeBob, but they don't say I'm a comedian. I will always reveal that, a story. And increasingly, obviously, sometimes people will know, but not lots of people don't know. But it's such, you know how easy it is when the expectation's really low. don't ever say I'm going to be funny.
And oh, like being in a play.
Yeah.
Like people watching a play. That's the dream audience.
Exactly. It's exactly that. I did get brought on to do an after dinner speech that was meant to be like a businessy one. And he brought me on. He was like, you'd have seen her on live at the Apollo and she's going to blow the roof off and she's so funny. And they literally had told me to do a business thing with sort of business take. And it was the hardest gig of my life. Everyone was like, oh God, this is, make this stop.
Oh God. And so how much of your life is circuit gigs versus these things? How much of your percentage of your time is doing regular gigs?
I guess overall, because I do a few different things as well. So I guess overall, I probably spend about 40, 50% of my time doing comedy. And I always realise when I actually spend all my time doing comedy. So in the lead up to Apollo, I obviously cleared the diary and just did nothing but stand up for 6 weeks. And I got so much better in 6 weeks. I was like, if I did this, I mean, I'm sure the deadline of that, I'm sure every comic will say, I kind of miraculously got a lot better in those 6 weeks. But I think I do sometimes think, and it goes in phases, I'll have 2 weeks of nothing but stand up and then 2 weeks of nothing but corporates or radio or whatever. And it definitely, you get into another world that's quite far away from, it's quite different bits of yourself, which sounds really wanky, but it is sort of true.
No, it's true. I guess we should talk about what you said at the beginning, which has never happened before, but you have died. You're dead. And you noticed, and that's unusual on this podcast, and I remembered too. How did you die?
I think there's only one way that anyone would have wished to die, and I'm really glad I died that way. And that was the same way as Isadora Duncan. So I had a beautiful scarf flowing at the back of a convertible, and it got caught in the wheels, and that's how I died. And Grace Kelly died in exactly the same, so not the same way with the scarf, but yes, Isadora Duncan died in that way in the 20s. And then 50-odd years later, on the same date, Grace Kelly died in a similar motoring accident, but without the scarf. But Isadora Duncan famously died on a jaunt with a young man she didn't really know much about, choked on her own beautiful headscarf.
Got hung herself on a headscarf whilst driving.
Yeah, he was driving. She was in the passenger seat and her beautiful flowing headscarf got caught in the wheels at the back of the convertible of a man she'd only met an hour before. Hell of a way to go, isn't it?
That poor guy. What a nightmare.
It's a bad first date, isn't it?
What a traumatic date that is.
Yeah, and that's before Tinder and stuff. Yeah.
And he probably didn't know her name. What a bloody nightmare that is.
Yeah. And
that's
she was young. I went the same way, but she had six adopted daughters, Isadora Duncan, and they carried on her sort of stuff in her image, and they were called the Isadorables.
Come on.
So this is a good way to die. So Grace Kelly died exactly the same date, about five decades later.
But not by scarf.
Not by scarf. But I've picked up the scarf again, and I've gone full Isadora.
Beautiful. I mean, not for the guy. I do worry about the guy. It does seem pretty like horrendous for the guy. But
yeah, but then he was trying to pick up a famous dancer with whatever line he had and whatever car. So
it seems like, I don't know that he's, I just don't know. It just seems very traumatic for everyone, that story. But who are you? Who's driving when you get killed by a headscarf?
I'm driving because I'm a very independent modern woman. So I'm driving with my own headscarf. Yeah, no one's implicated.
Fine.
Just me. The dog's not even in the car. Just me.
How old are you when this happens? How old do you want to be?
I think we'll go 45.
So you're 45, very young to die. Tragic. It wasn't, just to be clear, it was an accident.
Yeah, it wasn't an elaborate suicide.
Right, okay. You're 45 years old. Jesus, so young. I mean, people will talk about you. 45, people will say, what a tragic loss. What do you think happens when you die?
I think your spirit soars around the place, having a lovely connection with the people that you used to be with on this earth.
That's nice.
Yeah.
What, so the people know that?
Yeah, I think my kids would sort of know I was in orbit. The dog who sadly outlived me would sort of sense my presence. Yeah, I think it's like a sort of feeling, you know. You take the people with you that you love, don't you? There's still a bit of, you know, people that you love are still there with you. And I'd like to think I would be there, not in a haunting way, but in a sweet sort of reassuring way.
So you're sort of floating around, sort of like the Invisible Man, sort of flying around, and you check in with your daughter, you check in with your dog.
Yeah.
What's happening sort of between just watching things?
Yeah, not some. I mean, you're making it sound more creepy than it is. So I wouldn't be like just nosy. I wouldn't be like, who's my daughter dating and what's going on? But I would be, just a sort of reassuring the sense that someone's there, you know, a little breeze across the plant in the garden. Someone be like, I wonder if that's mum. That sort of thing, you know, a gentle, warm presence, which may or may not be how they see me in life.
Right. I guess I'm just trying to work out how you're using your time.
Yeah,
is it just you're constantly being a warm presence?
Just being a warm presence.
Like what's happening in the gaps when they're not in the garden?
Yeah, and just trying to trip up like Tory MPs in a sort of like cause sort of, not death, but, you know, perhaps not being able to work
mischief.
For a few months. Mischief, sort of dropping tapes of illicit gatherings on the mirror's doorstep, you know, things like that. Just a little bit of a little bit of political agitation, a little bit of fighting for social justice, and then some general good karma, namaste, spirit type stuff.
You're like you're very busy.
I've always liked to be busy in death as in life. Yeah.
So no rest for you. There's no heaven. There's no place you can just chill out.
Not a big believer in the old heaven.
You're just being a warm breeze and politically agitating.
Exactly. I think that's it. Yeah. And I mean, you know, you've got your death ahead of you, haven't you? You've got to make the best of it.
Love it. Well, I've got news for you. I'm afraid there is a heaven. I'm so sorry. And you're going to it. And it's filled with your favourite thing. What's your favourite thing?
My favourite thing is anything to do with animals, really. So it's filled with lovely little sort of puppyish, kittenish animals.
It's an animal sanctuary and it's filled with puppies and kittens and it's fucking great. They're everywhere. They are, you come in, they all run at you. There's so many of them. You can't see the floor for puppies and kittens. There's also puppy kittens, which is a half puppy, half kitten, hind legs of a cat, front of a dog. Very sweet. Aww. They're all excited to see you. There's also kitten puppies, front of a kitten, back of a puppy. All excited to see you. They want to talk to you about your life. They want to talk about it through film, which is weird for kitten puppies. The first thing they ask you is, what is the first film you remember seeing, Callie Beaton?
I love that question coming from a little cuppy. That's what I'm going to call them, little cuppies.
Little cuppy.
And they probably won't be pooing, kitten. Will they? Because it's heavenly. Ooh. So probably no poo and no wee.
No poo in heaven.
Yeah.
Famously.
Amazing. So my first film that I remember seeing, and I should say I'm not as old as this would make me seem, or I was not as old. So Whistle Down the Wind, ooh, which I'm sure you know. Yeah, so it's actually a film from 1961, and I obviously did not watch it in 1961 because I hadn't been born. But yes, it was a film that I saw in the 70s when I was a little girl. I reckon I was probably about 6 or 7. I was quite little. And it was Hayley Mills starred in it. It was actually written by her mum, I think. Mary Hayley Bell, who I think is Hayley Mills' mum. And do you know that? I'm sure you know about the film.
So I know the story and the script, but I don't know facts about the film if you're going to tell me.
Yeah, so the thing that stood out to me were a couple of things. One was I didn't think about this at the time, but all the main characters are children. Protagonists are all children. And that's, I don't think, I mean, like things like, I guess, like the railway children, I suppose that's also children protagonists, but I saw that kind of later. But it was the fact it was children and loads of children and all the big scenes were all little children. But it was also, I didn't realise, it's the whole thing's like an allegory for them thinking, they think they found Jesus Christ. That's what they found, this kind of guy that's actually, I think, a murderer, and he's hiding in a barn. He's a criminal anyway, a wanted criminal. And they think he's Jesus and they all come to the barn and he tells them stories and they all think and more children from like the little village kind of come to the barn and meet this guy. And I should say he's not in any way sinister towards the children, but he is a wanted man. And then at the end, he gets found by the police and he comes out with his arms outstretched like the sort of crucifixion. And I remember once I didn't know you could cry about a film or a book I just did as a little child. I don't know I don't think I realized that was a thing. And I found myself just absolutely sobbing, but being really embarrassed that I was crying in front of my parents and my brother. And it really moved me at an age when I didn't know film had the power to move you like that.
Yeah. So he gets arrested at the end.
Yeah, he gets taken away. Like, I don't think you know what's, I don't think you know what's where he's, I'm pretty sure he's obviously going to end up in prison, I guess. And all the children are there. Like, there's this big end scene and I mean, this is my plastic memory as one has. So maybe if you watched it, you'd be like, no, that isn't how it definitely ends, with him getting taken away. But my memory of it is all the different children, more and more had come along. And there's this massive sort of scene where he goes away. And then all these children, like, they've lost this massive part of their lives and this guy that they thought was their sort of idol, and he's gone.
Oh, heavy.
Very moving first.
I mean, great first film, and it's never come up on this. So great shout. What is the film that scared you the most? And do you like being scared?
I really hate being scared. I'm quite brave in life. Like, I live on my own and I don't worry about anyone breaking in, and I'll walk down the dodgiest street if it's a shortcut. So I feel sort of oddly invincible. Well, I did, until I realised no one's invincible. But I don't like being scared in films. I grew up as a teenager in the 80s, hanging out with mainly boys still. I don't know why I was still hanging out with boys, because by then I was at a mixed school, but I still was hanging out, I guess, for other reasons, like you would be hanging out with boys as a teenager. And we used to watch like Damon Omen 3 and Nightmare on Elm Street and Poltergeist and those kind of, and The Shining. We watched all that kind of stuff, which I now think those are all quite scary things to watch. And I absolutely have always hated anything like that. I hate, and I'm a BAFTA voter, so it's kind of awkward if there's a whole load of, I mean, you do have to watch them. There's a whole load of stuff, I don't really want to watch that. It's not my genre. Yeah. So I'm pathetic. I get so easily scared. Yeah. I don't like dark things.
Interesting.
I like fluffy lambs and puppies and kittens, as you know.
You like pittens. You'd be amazed or not how many comedians on here hate horror. So many. More than like it. Far more. I think it's to do with control. I think it's because we're all control freaks.
What do you think about horror?
I love horror, but I get why people don't like it. As in, I completely understand.
I like jumping off cliffs. I've done all the kind of extreme... I like extreme things to experience.
So you don't mind things that could kill you, but you don't like the idea of things that could kill you.
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
That's exactly it. Yeah, I just want to go straight in for the kill. I don't want to just piss around.
You'd rather be chased by Freddy Krueger than watch a film about Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, because then you've got a chance. You could control what you've got. It's in your hands how you respond. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that also a first for you on the podcast?
Yeah, the first person who's actively wished for Freddy Krueger to chase this so they have a chance.
Yeah, listen, I'm unusual.
What's the film that scared you the most?
Well, aside from those sort of teenage ones,
yeah,
which did all really scare me. And I did think about The Shining because I've watched that a couple of times and it scared the shit out of me, obviously. But I'm going to go for Cape Fear, but the remake, so the 1991 Cape Fear with Robert De Niro.
Martin Scorsese, I love that film. It's a great film, underrated.
So I went to see this without knowing what I was going to see. And I didn't really know. I just knew it was Robert De Niro. And I went with my mate, Jill, who I worked with back then. And this would have been when we were in our kind of early 20s. And I just didn't really know what it was. I knew it had Robert De Niro in. I knew it had Nick Nolte in, who I really liked. And I just had no idea what was about to befall me. And I remember watching it in a cinema in Notting Hill and just absolutely shitting myself. And the bit when he's under the car and at the end when he's, even when it gets beyond ridiculous at the end and he's talking in tongues and wearing a frock and everything else, I just found the whole, I just gripped my friend Jill and the arm of my seat and screamed about seven times. And I still remember the adrenaline surge I got watching that Cape Fear.
It's great, Cape Fear. It's really great. It's very exciting and fast. But I also, it's one of my favourite portraits of a marriage. Cape Fear is one of my favourite married couple films.
Definitely.
I think they're really interesting married couple that you don't see at the very deep, like for a film that's like a mainstream thriller, it's got a really interesting subplot about their marriage, which is quite dark and difficult and complicated. And it's great, great film. But yeah, it is also fucking scary.
I was saying it's also dark. I think that's the other, what you said just captured it perfectly. There's so many sort of dark, weird nuances to everything. There's no port in a storm. It's not like, oh, here's a sweet little family and now this bad thing's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's just everything is dark and weird and nuanced and nothing. You don't feel like the ground is safe anywhere, emotionally or physically. And the whole thing I found extremely impactful.
It's great.
Maureen, what's this I hear about you going to film school? I am. I want to gain valuable skills while making films and developing my creativity. So I'm attending the New York Film Academy. I'm thinking about becoming one of them people that writes the numbers on the title board. NYFA is a very respected film school. I hear they offer a variety of options to meet your educational goals, whether you want a BFA or MFA degree, or want to learn at a quicker pace with a short-term program. That's right! They've got workshops and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, cinematography, screenwriting, producing, game design, musical theatre, and more. Are you attending in New York? Might do. They have multiple campuses in some amazing locations like New York, LA, Miami, Italy, Australia, and online. And you can learn more about the New York Film Academy at nyfa.edu. That's nyfa.edu.
Thanks, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
What is the film that made you cry the most? And are you a crier?
A massive crier. I mean, such a crier. Yeah, I never was a public crier until my sort of 30s and 40s. A massive crier. You probably won't meet many women in their midlife who didn't learn to cry. A lot of hormones, a lot of crying. I think it's a big crying.
Oh, you think it was hormones that changed in your 30s?
I think hormones make you, even the non-crying women become crying women, I think, when the hormones start to go all over the place. But yeah, I was a big crier, big crier.
What's the film that made you cry the most?
I was torn between Kramer versus Kramer, which was another one that made me cry long before I thought you would cry that much about those things and long before I became a parent. But instead, so that would be my close second, but I'm going to go for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Ah, what a movie.
What a movie. And I mean, you and anyone listening will know why that would be, but it's so beautifully done. And to watch a love affair through the eyes of it being erased, what an incredible idea. And then that hopeless, this is a massive mistake. We don't want it erased. We want it still to exist. Just such an incredible concept and so beautifully done. And the music, and it just felt to me, I don't know when it was, like early 2000s, I guess. And it felt to me, and even though some of the music we obviously knew really well, like Mr. Blue Sky, it just felt like something I'd never seen before and a whole different way to make a film. And I watched it twice in fairly quick succession. I just loved it. Yeah. And it still I just think it's the most heartbreaking premise, isn't it?
It's also one of those films that I realize now, I'm like, it was like 20 years ago and people still reference it. Like the concept of it is so now used to describe other things. You know what I mean? Like people go, well, it's kind of like, you know, in Eternal Sunshine, like that's the barometer. In the same way that The Matrix, I don't think anything ever topped The Matrix. Like The Matrix is still a reference that you say, well, it's The Matrix. Do you know what I mean? And I think Eternal Sunshine is the same. Nothing has replaced it.
And it was sort of way ahead of itself as well. When you think about the idea of us, you know, memory being plastic and AI and how we can sort of relay the tracks of our life digitally and everything. It's sort of, even though it wasn't obviously a digital thing, it was a kind of, you know, chemical-based thing that happened. Yeah. But it was massively ahead of itself, wasn't it? Well, because at the time, I think even neuroscience, we sort of thought memories and like it was kind of laid down. I don't think neuroplasticity was even much of a thing. So it just was, just really powerful and so heartbreaking. And it makes me think every time you fall in love and you think about throwing it away, give it the Eternal Sunshine test and see if you really want to throw it away.
It's really beautiful. And the fact that they're going to do it all again.
Exactly. What a lovely, hopeful ending.
Yeah. Excellent answer. What is the film that you love? People don't like it. The critics hate it, but you love it unconditionally.
Again, there's a couple that came to mind, but I'm going to go with Point Break.
Hey. Oh, I suppose it probably wasn't adored at the time.
It was probably adored. It's probably one of those ones where people have retrofitted it now to go, it was a bit shit, when at the time it definitely got slated. I think it was seen as a sort of bit of a naff. I don't think anyone was holding it up as a sort of work of enormous art. It was obviously pre-Rotten Tomatoes, so how will we ever know? But I remember loving it. My holding it up against the light of was it critically acclaimed or not, was that everyone took the piss out of me for liking it so much.
You were ahead of the
curve. I was the focus group. So everyone I knew was like, you're an absolute dick for liking this film so much. So I think that means it wasn't well received.
I think you're right. I think it was misunderstood. It seemed like trash when it was, in fact, art.
It was art. It had, I mean, I was a skydiver at the time. And
really?
Yes. So when I say I like to jump off things and out of things, I mean it. And I'm sure you know this, but Patrick Swayze was a skydiver and he did his own, I'm sure you know, he always used to do his own stunts, and he did his own, that amazing culmination sort of skydiving scene. Patrick Swayze, no stunt double, and he did 55 jumps to get that right. 55. Wow. So I think that alone What other film could you say that about? Probably not a one. Whether or not it was Patrick Swayze.
Probably Mission Impossible. One of the Mission Impossibles. Tell me this. How many times have you jumped out of a plane?
Well over 200. So,
really?
Yeah.
So you could now do the wingsuit.
Yeah, the wingsuit depends on how fast you're trying to fall, as you probably know. So depending, as a woman, you tend to need a slick suit. So you need something without much by way of wings. You always have to have the bits people can hold on to so you can meet other skydivers. But you need to cut through the air quickly because everyone obviously falls at terminal velocity, but you reach terminal velocity marginally more slowly as a slightly smaller build woman than a big built guy. So, and that second or 2 seconds is a hell of a lot to lose when you've only got a minute or whatever it is before you're hitting the ground.
What? So you have to have more...
You need to be able to cut through the air more quickly on the exit from the aircraft so that you all
end. Oh, you need less. Right.
So you need less resistance. So as a woman, you have what's called a slick suit, which is very tight to your body and made of a fabric and is very much to cut to be aerodynamic.
But doesn't that mean if you had a wingsuit, you'd fly... better.
Yes, slower. But it would take you a long time. Yes, exactly. So if you're doing something on your own, you do what you like. But if you're trying to do formation stuff, you need to you need to be keeping with the pack, which when I used to do, I haven't done one for, God, 15 years. And when I was doing it, it was still wasn't completely male, but in keeping with the theme of the podcast, it was quite male. They used to call you a Doris if you were a female skydiver. That's what they called you, a Doris. That was all right. I stopped when I had kids. Yeah, and it became not so much that I was scared I was going to die, because it's actually quite a safe sport. It's massively regulated. You're much more dangerous to play rugby or whatever than to skydive. But it was just the time. You have to, if you skydive in the UK, you're spending many hours at drop zones waiting for the weather. And when you've got small children, it doesn't tend to go down well. If you say, I'm just going to fuck off for 48 hours and see if I get one skydive in, everyone seems to think that's quite selfish.
Wow. Absolutely fascinating. What is the film that you used to love, but you've watched it recently and you've thought, I don't like this anymore, for whatever reason?
Well, the test for this was with the kids, really. So when I try, and anyone who has kind of slightly older kids, I'm sure it's told you this and will tell you this. So you sort of watch, you want to show them something you absolutely love. You're like, wait till you see this. It's amazing. And it happens with music. You're like, listen to this. You know, I grew up loving this, and it just sounds so shit when you play it to them through their ears. And they're like, huh? Loyal Kana, it ain't. And that happens with movies as well. And Wayne's World was one where I told my daughter she would love it. Yeah. And we were on holiday together and I said, no, let's, we always watch, you know, movies in bed together at the end of the night. If we've gone out or whatever, we'll curl up and watch a movie. And I was like, you'll love it. It's so funny. And within about half an hour, I was like, this is like one of the least PC, fail the Bechdel test, kind of bit part women with people layering at their asses. You know, it was just, I was like, this is, and she was, she just, and also even the bits that were still funny to her as a Gen Z, she was like, this is just diabolical. So the comedy didn't translate. Some of it still translated to me, but not enough actually. And I just loved that film. So I was quite shocked that it so badly failed the test of time.
Well, comedy rarely does age well, sadly. But I think someone explained it on this and I was like, that's a very good theory. And it's because comedy is usually transgressive when it happens, but then society catches up to the thing it's transgressed. And so then it becomes dated.
So it goes from transgressive to retrograde in one swoop.
Yeah.
Because when the zeitgeist catches up.
Yeah, it's suddenly like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like it was outrageous one way and then it becomes outrageous the other way. Like, Jesus.
That's true, yeah. And I think particularly because it was such a parody on that sort of boys' bedroom nerdy, there was something so sort of 90s about what that was trying to say it was. And at the time I was working, I don't think I was quite working for MTV, I was about to start working for MTV. So that whole world was a world we inhabited, and Beavis and Butthead on the telly. And if you were into that kind of culture, and however we used to watch Saturday Night Live, I can't remember how we got it because it wasn't really legal, it wasn't easy to watch here. But all of that stuff, if you were into it, which was sort of underground culture over here, then that meant so much, that film. And all of that is irrelevant now to kids, I guess, my daughter's age.
Well, they were very sweet, Wayne and Garth, and nowadays they'd probably be incels. If they had the incel.
They would be. It's gone from cool to incel. And that's a bad transition by any stretch.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. What's the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is good, but the experience you had around seeing it will always make it special to you, Callie Beaton.
This will sound like a weird choice because, so it's the film that was kind of the soundtrack to me falling in love with my kid's dad, which would sound like a beautiful story were it not for the fact I split up with my kid's dad 20 years ago. So this may sound like a really weird choice, but we're really, really close still. So we're really a very sort of blended family, and he's always been a big part of my life and, of course, my kid's life. And so it does sound weird when we're talking about a broken up relationship, but I just remember meeting him when we both were working in telly in the early 90s, and he's Dutch, and he'd come over from Holland to sort of do a bit of summer cover for the Dutch guy that did the voiceovers, because we used to have a feed that went into Holland and the Benelux. So I got to know him, and we loved the soundtrack to that movie. Like, we were both really into music, and Harry Connick Jr. at the time was really cool, and everybody was just finding out who he was. And I always loved Nora Ephron's writing, and watching When Harry Met Sally and falling in love with somebody with a film that was such even the sort of vignettes of the kind of older couples and all of those things just hadn't been done before, as you know. And the fact they were a sort of unlikely couple and it was a sort of messy love story felt so apt. So I think the Nora Ephron, Harry Connick Jr. and the film itself, the sort of combination was a kind of Venn diagram that led to me, falling in love and having two kids with a lovely man.
That's fucking nice. That's very nice. All right. No follow-up questions. That's perfect. What's the film you most relate to?
This is going to sound like a weird one, but it's probably Gloria Bell, which was, did you see, there was about, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, and it's Julianne Moore. Yeah.
Yes.
And this sounds like one that should go in the kind of naff basket when you hear kind of what it is. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's her sort of in LA, and she's a divorcee, and she always used to dance, go to clubs and stuff, even within her unhappy marriage. And then she ends up having this whole sort of, it does sound really naff when you describe it, this whole kind of new lease of life, I guess, in her 50s probably. And it all the reason it's called Gloria is because it ends with her doing this amazing kind of dance to Laura Branigan's Gloria. But it is more subtle than it sounds. And I do like the fact, I would like this because I'm writing a book about this, that we sort of think that women in midlife might just about be able to hang on to what they had. Like, maybe I think that's the kind of narrative. We think that's quite a forward-thinking narrative. You might not lose everything in midlife. But we're at our absolute peak in midlife, and we might only just be starting with what we're capable of. And we might be having the first of many massive, powerful reinventions. And so I love the ambition in it and the way she portrays it. So it's not a sort of naff midlife crisis. It's like, I've only just started, is the message. And I think that's a brilliant message to see a woman in her 50s portraying on screen.
Incredible. I love her. She can do no wrong anyway.
She can do no wrong. I even, I watched, what was that film with her and Steve Carell? Is it Crazy Stupid Love? Which I didn't watch at the time, and because I thought it looked so enough. But I ended up watching that as a sort of like, kind of like shitty, like I watch a thing. And then I was like, oh God, this is, I like her in everything. I thought it was good.
She's never been bad.
Never been bad. Very beautiful.
Beautiful. Ooh. Speaking of which, what's the sexiest film you've ever seen?
I think it's got to be, for my sort of age group, this is probably not that unusual, it's got to be Thelma and Louise, because that's when we discovered Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And it was sexy anyway, because Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon were so sexy. And at the time, it hadn't occurred to me that I would ever go on to date women and that I fancied women. It wasn't sort of on my, wasn't really thinking that I did. But I guess looking back at it, I did. So it was them. And it was him, and it was the whole, but that, the sort of him and Gina Davis sort of sex scene. I mean, once you've seen that, who can unsee that and who would wish to?
It's a heck of a first film for Brad Pitt. It's a heck of an entrance. You know what I mean?
Naked in a Stetson. What other entrance do you want?
No wonder he's the biggest film star. Incredible. There's a subcategory to this question. Troubling boners, worrying why don't. Film you found arousing that you weren't sure you should.
This is so bad, I'm not sure I should disclose it, because it's a really dark one to have found sexy, because it was a film it was meant to make you think that sort of sleazy sex was disgusting. And it was Shame. It was Michael Fassbender, depicted as a horrible, disgusting, depraved sex addict.
And such a good answer.
I just thought, I couldn't...
You thought, this is aspirational.
I couldn't stop thinking, but it's Michael... Look, you know, it's Michael Fassbender, who is so sexy. And everybody, my friendship group were like, what is... I was like, but you must have fancied him a bit in it. And they were like, no, same way we didn't fancy him in 12 Years a Slave. And I was like...
Did you find that one challenging
as
well?
That one I did not. I drew the line of fancying him in that one. But this one, I think because it was in the general arena of sex and it was him and it was... Yeah. And that, I don't know if you know where they filmed the scene, you know, against the with that floor-to-ceiling glass in the hotel. That's the standard in New York. And you can walk along the High Line and see that room. I've walked along the High Line and seen that room many times.
That's such a great answer. And now I'm thinking about that film, I'm like, I liked that film, but I don't remember thinking, oh, God, sex is bad. I don't think it, if that was the message, I maybe didn't get it. You and I watched it and thought this is an aspirational
drama. Yeah, we were like, imagine having all that sex and being hot and being able to afford to do it in a 5-star hotel with random people. That's so cool.
Maybe you and I thought the title meant, what a shame we can't afford this lifestyle.
That's exactly it, yeah. So, yeah, it did not bring out any shame in me, apart from a shame that's I wasn't so there.
Funny. Yeah, no, that's a good answer. Well done. What's objectively, might not be your favourite, but objectively the greatest film of all time, Kelly Beaton?
Such a tough one, but I think it's got to be One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for me.
Fantastic.
Wonderful. And I think it's, well, and I'm going to maybe retrofitting why I think it's my son ended up playing Billy Bibbit in a school production. And that, if ever I hadn't found the, you know, the kind of dialogue powerful, I bloody did after watching my son doing it. But that, everything about that film and the kind of end scene and the kind of pillow over the face and the breaking through the window and nurse and all the characters. I mean, there isn't really a character in that film that isn't outstanding in terms of the writing and the portrayal. I don't think there's a weak link.
Yeah.
And it's so beautifully sort of filmed. And again, just not a, just very subtle as well in lots of ways for something at that time about that subject. And I think if the test is, and I always think about this when I'm voting for films, and I try and always think, what's the footprint afterwards? How do they resonate or not? And that one just has always resonated with me. And every time I see it, it just sort of blows me away. So, I mean, it's so hard to pick the film, but I'd say if I was forced to pick it, it would be that.
I love it. It's a great answer. And it should come up here more and it doesn't. So you get 10 points for that. Wow. You finally started scoring points.
Amazing.
What is the film you could or have watched the most over and over again?
Again, this comes back to, I've mentioned my daughter a lot, but we watch a lot of films together. It's going to be Bridesmaids with her specifically, she and I. And we sort of have to tell ourselves how long, we have to ration Bridesmaids. So we have to go, when did we last watch it? And if it's too recent, we go, we probably have to wait a bit. So we have to sort of make ourselves watch a couple in between sort of things. And we don't see each other, you know, that often because she lives away. So yeah, Bridesmaids, I'd say she and I have watched that a lot. And I've probably watched it a good couple of times without her as well.
We also have talked about this, is Bridesmaids hasn't been topped. There hasn't been a Bridesmaid since Bridesmaid.
No, and I think that's going to be a hell of an ask for there to be one, because every time I watch it, another bit comes in and I'm like, that's so well written. It's, and everything just comes together. And people who think it's like a naff, kind of shitty sort of comedy thing on, you know, that you might watch kind of late night because nothing else, it's not, it's so, and they're so
It's
brilliant.
Like the last exceptionally great Hollywood mainstream cinema comedy. I can't think what's been as good. That was
and
like
with
a big
female
film.
Protagonists. Who are so good and so varied.
Yeah. It's just a fucking funny, well-made. It's great. Guys, great. What is, at the other end of the scale, we don't like to be too negative, but what's the worst film you've ever seen?
That's the other thing about voting for things, is you see a lot and you see things that you think are going to be shit and then you go and see them. You still have to go see it and you're like, I was right, that was shit. And you wouldn't bother paying to go see it, but you obviously need to see stuff. So I've seen some shit because of getting... You know, having to see some shit. And it, amidst all of the shit, Mother. Did you watch Mother?
I did watch Mother. I love it, but I absolutely understand that.
Tell me why you love it, because I'd love to hear the counterpoint to my dismissal of it.
Because there's nothing like it. I like anything where I'm like, well, I've never seen anything like that.
That's very true. I agree with you on that. Nothing like it.
It's wild. I definitely wasn't bored. I was sort of really stressed by it. Like, it was like having a panic attack for ages.
Yes.
I kind of, the last half hour was like, Jesus Christ. And it kept getting wilder. You sort of thought, well, we must have peaked, but then it kept going. And I just thought, I've never seen anything like this. This was fucking wild. Whatever just happened, I certainly wasn't bored and I was fully engaged for the 2 hours.
I was definitely engaged.
Nightmare ride.
Yeah. Well, you thinking surely now they've reached the peak. That was me thinking, surely now it should have ended. So I was at that right. point for the last. I was like, okay, now it's got to end. And I think it was also, whenever I go to see those films that haven't come out yet, you'll know this, like you don't, because you haven't seen the films and the marketing campaign, it's really funny yeah. how different your opinion is. I saw La La Land not even knowing what it was about. I hadn't even read the blurb right. and I just knew Ryan Gosling was going to be at a Q&A. So I was like, I'm in. And then so the whole of that opening sequence of La La Land, I didn't know what to expect. I had no idea yeah. that's what the movie, and right. I think it must have had double the impact at least because I didn't know. And similarly yeah. with Mother, I had no idea what I was going to see. It sounds like even when you did, it was surprising. I just yeah. thought it had this incredible cast and I yeah. just couldn't stand it.
I don't think you're wrong, as in I know so many people who really hated it and it's incredibly disturbing and weird. I just don't ever want to be bored and I definitely don't think it's boring.
It definitely wasn't boring. I didn't want to yeah. leave because it was boring. Yeah.
Yes.
And it was definitely upsetting. An uncomfortable watch and distressing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And did but not get wild. My vote. Did not get my vote.
That's fair. But it's also technically, and maybe you don't, it's technically very impressive.
I did give it a technical, yes, because you do vote yeah. on those things as well. I completely think in terms of production and I think there was a hell of a lot about it that stood up.
Yeah, but you were like, but why?
If you look at the technicalities of making a film. But as a punter watching a film, I was like, no, thank you.
Yeah, totally fair. You're in comedy, you're very funny. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
Going for an oldie but a goodie, Life of Brian.
It's great.
It's the first film I remember absolutely. And I probably wouldn't have watched it. It came out in the 70s. When it came out, I'd have probably been 9 or 10. So I very much doubt I would have watched it at 9 or 10. I can't imagine who'd have taken me to watch it. But I would have watched it not long after that. It was my first kind of exposure to, I guess, probably to the Pythons. It was, I think at the time, things like Not the 9 o'clock News were on telly and I was starting to think about that sort of type of stuff that was going on, which yeah. felt very different. It was obviously pre things like The Young Ones and it just laid the ground. And when I look back at it, I mean, I pissed myself without knowing why I was pissing myself, but I just found it. And I don't think I'd seen anything so absurd. I don't think, obviously, I wouldn't have used the word irreverent. But obviously, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
I was brought up in a sort of quite a traditional family. You went to church on Sundays. I just absolutely loved it. I thought it was amazing. And I still think it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's their best film.
Definitely their best film.
It's moving. The ending is amazing. It actually makes sense as a story. I love it. It's a masterpiece. Yeah. Yeah. Really well made. Seems real. It's great.
And now Michael Palin is a nearby neighbour and I spend my whole life hoping I'll bump into him getting a coffee, which very occasionally happens. Yeah, he lives between me and Lou Sanders.
Have you said hello? Oh my God.
Imagine how happy he is living between me and Lou. He'll
be like,
imagine
lucky boy.
Every day hoping he bumps into one of us probably.
What a treat. Have you said hello to him?
I have seen him a couple of times around and about, yeah, but I don't want to be, I don't want to fangirl him. So
that's a difficult person to meet. Like I sort of, he would be on my list of people. I wouldn't really want to meet him because I like him so much. A, I wouldn't know what to say in a brief period of time. And B, if I had a bad interaction, it would ruin my life. I'd just rather not.
You'd have to garrote yourself on a long scarf and a convertible if it didn't go well.
Yeah, that's probably what happened, wouldn't it? Maureen, what's this I hear about you going to film school? I am. I want to gain valuable skills while making films and developing my creativity. So I'm attending the New York Film Academy. I'm thinking about becoming one of them people that writes the numbers on the title board. NYFA is a very respected film school.
I hear they offer a variety of options to meet your educational goals, whether you want a BFA or MFA degree, or want to learn at a quicker pace with a short-term programme. That's right! They've got workshops and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, cinematography, screenwriting, producing, game design, musical theatre, and more. Are you attending in New York? Might do. They have multiple campuses in some amazing locations like New York, LA, Miami, Italy, Australia, and online. And you can learn more about the New York Film Academy at nyfa.edu. That's nyfa.edu. Thanks, Maureen.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hello, my neighbour Maureen. What's this I hear about you getting a promotion at the office? Didn't you just get promoted last month? It's all thanks to Canva. I've been nailing every meeting with AI-powered Canva presentations. Isn't that Canva's AI slide generator, where you just describe your presentation in a few words and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides in seconds? That's right. And to top it off, I use Magic Write, Canva's AI text generator, to perfect my points. Sounds brilliant, Maureen. No more copying and pasting from other programs. No more app switching. Can Canva Docs with Magic Write generate any text you want for work? Yes. Sales proposals? Marketing plans? Yeah. Meeting agendas? Ratings of all 12 Muppet movies using the extensive point system that I developed at age 12? Anyone can save time with Canva's AI-powered tools. Generate your draft fast with Canva Docs at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my neighbour Maureen. Yeah, thank you. Callie Beaton, you have been an absolute delight. However, when you reached 45 years old, you went on your own for a drive. You just bought a convertible. You were like, I made some money. I'm going to treat myself. My daughter's in Spain. My son's somewhere else. The father's somewhere else. I'm going for a drive. You went out. Sun was out. Let me put the roof down. Still a bit of a chilly wind, so I will wear this long, long scarf that I've bought. You put the scarf on. You went for a drive. You went on the A4. You're on the A4 and you're heading towards something beginning with B that's on the A4. Brockington or something. You're heading to Brockington and having a lovely time. And as the wind catches your scarf and you're singing along to Raindrops Keep Falling From My Head, the scarf gets caught in the back tyre. And within an instant, your head is popped off. And rolls across the motorway, gets run over by 5 different cars and a truck, and then squashed like a watermelon. You, your body still holding the wheel, foot still on the accelerator, keep driving for ages. It's a long straight road, the A4. At some point, there's a turn. Thankfully, it turns to the right because you veer straight off into a bush. The car falls down a ditch, bang, explodes, as all cars do in films when they fall off sides of things. So there's a big fireball over here and a watermelon squashed head. I'm walking along the A4 with a coffin. You know what I'm like? I say, has anyone seen Callie Beaton? I heard there was an explosion up ahead. They go, yeah, there's no evidence that she's been in either of these places. And I go, but what about this big splat over here? So stop the cars. I go, bloody hell, I'd recognize that strand of hair anywhere. That's got to be her. I get a digger. I have to dig up the tarmac because you're properly immersed into the ground. We dig up bits of road, stick as much as you as there is, which isn't much, it's just the remains of your head, bits of brain, stuff it all in a coffin. But there's more tarmac than I was expecting, so it's rammed. It's only enough room in this coffin now for me to slip one DVD into the side of the coffin for you to take across to the other side. On the other side, it's movie night every night. What film are you taking to show the cuppies and pittens in heaven?
Only one possible choice, Little Miss Sunshine.
Beautiful. And the cubbies and pittens are going to love it. And you're going to sit with them, have a cuddle and watch it. Callie Beaton, what a lovely time. Is there anything you would like to tell people to listen to or watch coming up?
my podcast, Namaste Motherfuckers, weekly podcast. So that is very much worth checking out. So, and my book coming out, but not soon enough. It's worth plugging that, but stay tuned for that. And all my live stuff, you can see on my website all the other stuff I'm up to, bits of telly and radio and, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Do you have a title for the book?
I do, but I'm not going to say it yet.
It's catchy.
It is catchy. But if I said it, I'd have to explain it and then...
Okay.
We'd lose all the beautiful crescendo of this entire experience. It would turn into an elevator pitch for Penguin.
Gally Beaton, thank you so much for your time and for doing this. Good day to you.
Thank you for having me.
So that was episode 265. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra secrets and video with Callie. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, but don't talk about the show. Talk about the film that means the most to you and why. Everyone loves reading that. Makes them all cry. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you're all well. Thanks so much to Callie for doing it. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to iHeartMedia and Will Ferrell's Big Money Players Network for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week for a fucking smasher of a guest. You are going to really like that one. So that is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen. Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant. Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my neighbor, Maureen. Yeah, thank you.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.